Fully Loaded Chew is tobacco-free, long cut, and pouches that gives you the same pack, dip, spit, and buzz that you're used to without tobacco. Fully Loaded Chew comes in 9 flavors and is made with all food-grade ingredients and tobacco-free nicotine, the purest form of nicotine there is. To give us a try, head on over to fullyloadedchew.com for a $1 can of chew with free shipping when you enter the code OUTDOOR1. OUTDOOR and the number 1. Lastly, many outdoorsmen are trying to quit tobacco altogether, and Fully Loaded Chew may be that first step. For more information on our product line, visit fullyloadedchew.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys. Land and Legacy Podcast. Adam and Matt, where are you?
We're here.
You're there. We do 2 of these a week. Some weeks it is just a daggum drag, I'll be honest with you. It's like, why are we continuing doing 2 a week? You know?
Because that's what they want.
Yeah.
They want that
You threaten it on there. You threaten it on social media. I had a guy, there was a guy was talking a while back. One of our good friends, Hunter, was, he had posted something and some guy, I don't remember what said, like, no fluff, or I wish they'd stop fluffing it up or whatever. And it's like, gee, guy, we've been 30-minute podcasts here lately because we've been so busy, but 2 hours a week. I don't know of anybody who talks 2 hours a week about something as technical as habitat and avoid fluff. That you might as well go to, if you want 2 hours uninterrupted, no fluff, go to a university.
Oh, there's plenty of fluff there, I can promise you.
Yeah, well, that's true, but at least you'll get it in a monotone. So
that's it. That's
yeah,
right.
With no jokes. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Dry.
Yeah. So, I mean, for us, here we are, another podcast this week, hammering them out. My goodness, we've been doing this a while. We're way up there in podcasts now. I don't even know how many so far, but over 350, I believe. I kind of got lost in the transition to
350. There's way above that, yeah.
Yeah, we're probably closer to 400 now, but it's hard to say. Because the numbers are off when you look at our feed, because we've been with Dan when we jumped over on the network. So anyway, one thing before I forget, Legacy 20, right? Vortex Optics.
Vortex Apparel.
Yep. If you're looking for Vortex Apparel, head over vortexoptics.com and use the promo code Legacy20. To get some awesome stuff they've got over there in the store. On the other podcast this week, we talked about the first few days of hunting season and what we've seen. You know, Chad shot a nice doe. We've seen some nice bucks. Seen one shooter. Chad saw some shooters. Was that opening night that he saw the nice buck?
He saw the night, no.
The night before opening night.
No, because I sat that field and I did not see them. It was like the night before that.
Okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Or two nights before that, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. A couple nights. It was Sunday night, I believe, when he went and watched it. So, yeah. And then season opened on Wednesday. So it was a couple nights before, saw a nice buck. So we've got our eyes on some really good bucks. Cameras are showing up. Timber harvest is still going on Whistling Woodlands. So that's been a kind of – we don't have a ton of cameras out because we don't want them to get smashed. With logs or skitters, so here we are. But
deer are starting to pile in here at Elam Ridge. We're starting to see a lot more activity daylight on cameras as well as in the back food plot, and then the lease is also lighting up. There's a lot of deer on it, but it's waiting for the right ones to show up before putting any pressure on it. It's like new deer, I would say, every 2 or 3 days. Like, don't know that one.
Yeah.
Don't know that one. Haven't seen you all summer. Where are you coming from?
I put out some more cameras on the family farm yesterday. I was out zipping around doing some fence stuff for the cows, and so you know, I'll be interested. I officially mock scraped everything, and Brett was asking me, the guy that filmed me yesterday, if I put out mock scrapes, and it was like, I don't really know how to define a mock scrape other than what I'm doing is really just freshening up scrapes. I didn't hang any licking branches. All I did was took historical licking branches that they've used in the past, and I made that the first scrape of the fall in that area. So, you know, and I knocked out, took the weed whacker, and I knocked out a bunch of stuff and made it good and short. And kind of the goal with that is, it's not really a mock scrape. I'm opening up or activating the scrape that I want them to use first thing. Because I feel like if I go in a month from now or a couple weeks from now and they're already using other ones around and trying to pull them over to the one I want might not be as successful as, hey, we already opened one up.
Yeah. One of the other things I've seen in the last couple of years, there's portions of the country where testosterone's rising, velvet shedding, and they start to open up scrapes, obviously on their own. And I know there's some scraping happening now, naturally.
Yeah.
But when it's half-rack, really dry.
He made a scrape yesterday.
Say that again?
Oh, half rack.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But when it's super dry and there's no moisture in the soil to hold scent, I don't see them doing it nearly as much as when it's actually wet and I feel like useful for them to do so. But regardless of that, if you do open one up and they frequent that area walking by using that licking branch, you can almost kind of jump start some of that. Like, oh, someone's been here. They at least open it up.
Yeah.
And start kind of utilizing it. So you do get that jump on it. But, right, I wouldn't say mock scrape is necessarily the best term for it.
Now, you put instance. Out what I would call a mock scrape.
Yes, I did. Yes. What I put out, T-post, saplings, wire to them, field edges, and to try and give another focal point for deer trying to survey a larger field on time lapse during the day, but then another focal point to capture them in the camera to survey that larger food plot. Those absolutely were mock scrape. But what's interesting about that, and I was on the lease, there was a fire that went through there, and a lot of the mid-story and low-hanging branches around field edges and or just in the timber, they're gone. So there's very few scraping limbs out there. Yeah. So last year, I cut a limb and then zip-tied it to another tree as another mock scrape, just because the opportunities for scraping, they were just so few, but it just put it in an area that deer were crossing routinely and got quite a bit of activity on it. And so, however you want to do it, whatever you want to call it, it works to congregate, slow deer down, get better images of them, and kind of give them that focal point to communicate. So we do it a lot from a inventory standpoint.
Yeah, for sure. And that kind of transition in, cameras, adding cameras, doing all that thing, and using trail cameras as a primary source of scouting for your hunting strategy. At some point during the fall, most guys deal with this week's topic, and that being nocturnal bucks, nocturnal deer, nighttime photos. Why is it occurring? So, if you probably hear, because you saw the title, Five Reasons Why Your Bucks Are Nocturnal. We'll go through the top five reasons in our opinion of why your deer are nocturnal.
Yeah, these are the commonly held reasons why that we can sit here and pinpoint, say, okay, this is likely. And if it doesn't fall under these five situations, sure, there's others, but I would say 85% of the reasons why are included in these top five.
Yeah.
And they're just, this is the common thing. And I feel like if you're not aware the nocturnal nature, and I'm air quoting that, of what you think is happening and occurring, that can provide a lot of frustration or be the root of a lot of frustration for hunters. I mean, I got these deer and they're great and they're big and they're what I want to chase, but they're only nocturnal. And I think that can obviously create that frustration, but then be very discouraging. But there's so much more. The good thing is to know that you're capturing them on camera, but to hunt them, that's just not where you hunt them.
Yeah.
Don't just take that for what it is and say, oh, well, they're nocturnal. It's not worth going in there after them, or I'm not going to have much luck here because it's just nocturnal movement, blah, blah, blah.
Or hunting them, even though all the photos in that spot are 2 a.m.
Yeah. Well, that's not where I'm going to hunt him.
No.
Like,
at least I know he's in the area, but I got to figure out where he's at least bedded down.
And this is the whole point of the podcast is I feel like a lot of times we can look only at the trail camera images and just throw out the almost excuse of, well, he's just nocturnal, or just accept it. But there are way more, there is a lot more mature buck movement than in a daylight hour situation than a lot of people understand. And I think that's
agreed. Totally. 100%.
A lot of it is simply because they don't know how to document properly and take that inventory of what deer are doing with trail cameras. They rely so heavily on trail cameras that they're placed in these set spots year after year, or just like the most commonly held, of course you're going to put it on a food plot, or of course you're going to put it on that one crossing or something like that. But is that really where deer are daylighting a lot? Well, no. Yeah. So why do we expect them to be not nocturnal so many times, but big deer move during daylight. I 100% believe that. And I believe that it's way more than people give them credit to. They're wise and they're leery, but they move and they walk during daylight.
That's right. Yep.
So we got a pretty good list here.
No doubt. I think number one, that in our opinion, I feel like this is like you could end the podcast with this, just this one.
I think this of that 85%, the five, and I say 85 because I'm generous. I think it's more like 95%, but the five cover number one, I feel like covers 75%.
Oh, totally. Yes. I'll just say yes. because number one, like, and I would love to just go through all the others and compare to number one, because number one, sure, to me is that's the meat and potatoes of all of it. Why are your deer nocturnal? Why are they only at night? Because they are, number one, bedded too far away.
Yeah.
And what do you mean bedded too far away? Meaning they're bedded a good ways away from that trail camera location. And I think that comes back, you know, we do, our message and our business is focused so much on habitat and habitat management, natural resource restoration, that we don't really talk a lot about our hunting strategy nearly as much as we could, because like ultimately we were hunters first. And yeah, because we wanted to be more successful hunting, then that led us down the path of understanding how to be more successful by manipulating the landscape. And here we are going, you know what? When you make dense cover and you stay out of it and you put it in locations that allow you to stay out of it and you use terrain features that, here we are, we're on a hunting podcast talking to habitat, but... And you use terrain features that we know deer like to bed in, and we make dense cover there. It's like, boom, our cameras are daylight. Our bucks are moving in daylight. It's hot. It's cold. It's whatever the conditions. They're still moving in daylight. Why is it? It's the lockdown. Well, you know what lockdown means to me? They're closer to the bedding areas.
Yeah, exactly.
And so... Or why are your deer nocturnal?
Oh, yeah, it's the October lull, but my deer are still daylight? Why is that? Because I'm still close to bedding. And so why are my deer nocturnal? Because they're bedded a long ways from your camera.
Well, I think that's a twofold deal. It's about the proximity, so the distance, right, from your camera. But when you do manipulate the habitat in the manner that we talked about, you're telling, like, you know where they're at. So many times with these pictures, you get clients talking about them, or you know, listeners, just common discussions you might see on social media too is, hey, I got this buck. It's nocturnal. It's like, okay, my first question to you would be, where's it bedding? And the only statement or the only information that they have is the fact that, well, I just got this picture. Like, that's all I have. There's no more information detailed about the deer itself. It's just, well, he showed up here. Okay. That's not enough to go off of. What the habitat, true habitat manipulation will do is dictate that. You will be the one saying, this is where, this is how deer are going to be bedded on your place.
Yeah.
So you can change that distance from your camera location, which obviously that's another point we'll get into later on, but you can easily change that by manipulating where the deer are, but you have to know where they're bedded. You can't just guess.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I think too, the situation is they're bedded just off the property. They're not even on you.
Yep. I mean, many, many times, even how many, we have a lot of clients who own pretty big properties, and even them, even they are going, yeah, this deer is, he's not moving during daylight. And we're going, he's probably on the neighbor, which is a terrible, awful to think that you own all that land and you can't even get them to bet on you.
Right, right. That's the solution, though.
And I am totally guilty of that. Like, the Whistling Woodlands Ranch is horrific for that. Has been forever. My family farm has been like that for a long, long time. But it's changed pretty quickly in the last 5 years with some pretty aggressive cutting.
But let's be honest, though, with that, too. It's not to the point of being aggressive.
Big scale,
right. It's been aggressive in a couple pockets that you feel comfortable sacrificing, but not across the board.
And ironically, that's where our best hunting has been.
That's funny how that works out.
Yeah.
But back to the whole nocturnal thing is, guys, they're bedded too far away. They're traveling a distance from wherever your camera is. And I would say majority of cameras are placed on food plot locations, destination type food plot locations. And with that being said, that kind of combination automatically puts them on those locations late into the day.
Yeah.
I mean, most of that activity is going to be at night or the last little bit of night. So do you expect it to not be nocturnal? I mean, especially when you don't know where it's bedded, of course it's going to be nocturnal, right? That's kind of a function of where they're at. But, like, you've got to be able to cut down the distance of bedding to food to increase daylight activity, because right now big bucks are moving during daylight. They're going to be doing the same thing in October and November and the rest of the month of the year. They do it. It's just oftentimes they do it in areas that are very secure. And there's not a lot of places that have the combination of security and quality cover that will encourage that daylight movement.
Yeah.
But that's where that habitat manipulation comes in.
Yep, totally. Number two,
what we got?
Pick your poison here. I think number two would be out of the core area. Mm. And, you know, we use the term a buck's home range and a buck's core area. You could look at it from, you know, a cracked egg in the pan has the white, which is his home range, and the core area being the yolk. The yellow part.
The white part's good for you, but not as good as the yellow part.
That's right. I was going to say.
It's more dense nutrients.
Yeah, that's. I was going to say, you know, the good flavor of the egg right there in the yellow in that core area. That's, you know, sunny side up, baby. Let me dip my toast in there. So you've got your core area. And a lot of times, these are those mid, to me, these are those bucks show up. They've just shed their velvet. They're shifting around in their fall winter ranges. And all of a sudden you get a few pictures of a buck, but it's in the middle of the night. And you're like, what in the world? You know, that's a deer that's not in his core area. It's in his home range, and it may be the very outskirts of his home range, but it's not definitely not his core area. So, therefore, you're only getting pictures of him when it's middle of the night and he makes those big walkabouts and he ends up on your place.
Yeah, yeah. It's usually the nighttime, and it's not a frequent thing. It's very infrequent. It's, man, that buck shows up every couple of weeks. I'll get pictures of him. Okay. He's not choosing to spend the majority of his time outside of his core area. It's still within his home range. But again, going back to proper habitat manipulation, you can dictate that selection of habitat and then shifting of home ranges, core areas, when there's different resources across, let's say, a square mile, right? Yeah. So if you've got neighbors and all of you, your properties look roughly the same, you all are all offering the same resources available times of the year, there's no like rhyme or reason for the selection from a deer, right? So if it all looks the same, why would they do anything different than they've done? But when you start going in there and being aggressive, you can change where the yoke is. And where I want to say a lot of the core area movement, not the home range, but the core area movement, that's 65%+ of their time being spent. And that's through, you know, GPS tracking. Sometimes those core areas are 40 acres. Sometimes they're, you know, 40 to 100 acres in size. So if a deer spending 65%+ of its time at the core area in that small of an acreage, then that is awesome. I think from a hunting standpoint, I'd want to hunt that deer. He's not going all over God's creation. He's pretty tied close to that, but you just have to have those resources that attract and make sure that they're not traveling, you know, miles to get what they need or across property lines to get what they need. Pack it in, create that density that they need from a resource, food resource and cover resource and security resource. And then you'll change that game. You'll change he's not on your place anymore. So infrequent, it's more frequent. That's what we all want.
Yeah.
It's funny, Adam, how many things. And I know obviously our business is roughly, you know, habitat manipulation. But these aren't just like, oh, things that we're just throwing out as possible solutions. This is the solution. Like it's not like you can go and create a mock scrape or put a mineral out and all of a sudden these home ranges are going to change or he's going to now start coming to this mineral block at the destination food source in the daytime.
Yeah.
No. That's not a solution. That doesn't fix stuff.
That doesn't. It not at all. Food plots. Amazing looking food plots doesn't change that. Mineral feeders, all that stuff can help try to change it, but it still doesn't fix the overall problem. It's a Band-Aid on a bullet hole.
Yeah. And I want more bullet holes, dang it.
Yeah. Oh man. So yeah, that one right there. You know, out of the core area, that one, you know, those two things, you know, those two right there can be it. Like, wrap the pod cap stuff, slap your hands, wash your hands, be done with it. But we got five of them. Why?
Yep.
Because we thought five sounded better than two reasons why.
And they're not, it's not like they don't have a impact, but It's just that the situations that most people find themselves in, these aren't the most influential variables in the whole equation.
Yeah. So the other thing, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say it because I feel like this is number one in most people's head of why their deer are nocturnal.
Yep.
Pressure is too high, meaning I've hunted him too hard. I've alerted him too much. The neighbor's dog's running through and pushing him off. You know, my cousin keeps hunting the farm.
Predators.
My cousin keeps hunting the farm when I can't hunt it. The too many dang coyotes. I guess when you're talking negative about them, too many coyotes. All those things. The pressure's too high. Not saying that this doesn't create nocturnal bucks, but it's a very smidgen of the pie graph. It's not a big thing, in our opinion, that really plays into making deer nocturnal. We believe that the first two, they're bedded too far away. Now, here's the thing. Pressuring your deer can cause them to bed in other places, and then therefore they're nocturnal because they're bedded too far away.
Right. They seek refuge farther away from where they had been normally. Yeah. And is that a function of pressure? Yeah, that is a function of pressure, but it's also a function of distance and spatially moving farther away. And it's also a function of crappy habitat. Because
right.
what deer will do is tolerate way more disturbance and pressure if adequate and quality cover is present. I mean, you could get away with so much more activity on a farm if your woods aren't a park opposed to thick, dense bedding areas.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a rocket science to figure that one out either. But they just tolerate so much more activity. So that pressure one, man, I mean, that definitely is default number one, I think, for a lot of people. And in high hunter density areas, I think it does have a stronger play than others, but that's at very certain times of the year. There's people right now who their season hasn't opened and they're sitting there thinking, oh, man, this deer's just nocturnal.
Yeah. Well,
where's the pressure, guys?
Yeah.
Where's the pressure? He's not nocturnal. It's one of the other factors.
Yeah.
And so we see that and hear that from hunters when it's not even a variable because there's no one hunting deer at those time frames.
Yeah. Yeah. So next up, pressure too high. That's just, oh, unless you had more you wanted to add on that one.
Well, I would.
You
want to
beat this dead horse?
I was just going to say, if the pressure's too high, the only other way to solve that is reduce the pressure in your place because you can't control what the other people are doing. And I think when you have a high, typically when you have a high pressure area, you have smaller parcels and a lot of hunters. And so if you can be a 40-acre chunk or an 80-acre chunk that's surrounded by pressure, you just back off. And now you've become the place where these nocturnal deer are seeking. So you could play it kind of two ways. Even in high deer density area, I mean, high hunter pressure areas, you just have to know how to play the cards right and turn that nocturnal movement into daylight movement. Because again, even in high pressure areas, bucks still move during daylight. They do.
No doubt.
What's number four?
Number four, temps too high, meaning, you know, I think of October lull, whenever,
sure.
You know, temps are just too high. Now, certainly, let's just draw up the perfect world, the perfect farm, and say, you know, between where this deer beds 75% of the time from September 15th, October 15th, I'm just pulling out a month-long window there. From where he beds and where he typically goes, playing it by the numbers, 3 out of 5 days, it's 150 yards. So out of those 3 out of the 5 days, let's just say seven, I guess. So 4 out of the 7 days given the week. So there's 16 days in that 30-day window that he's in this food plot during daylight. That's, I mean, that's pretty good odds, 16 days.
Yeah,
a lot of guys would shoot for those odds.
I'd hunt that.
If you were to experience higher temperatures, yes, I believe that you would not see him there 16 days out of the 30. I think it would knock it down because there's days he's going to lay in his bed and hang out a little bit longer, and yep. It would take him longer to get there. Or he may take a more shade-ridden route down to the food plot because it is so hot. So certainly temperatures can have an effect on daylight activity and why they're not in front of your camera during daylight. It's a very small scale. I don't feel like it's got a huge attraction because deer still got to eat. They're still going to move. They're not going to lay in their bed.
Day-to-day function, too. I mean, that changes so much. And so to say that he's nocturnal because it's been hot, well, man, 2 weeks ago there was a cold front, and he didn't show up in your
camera.
He's
still wearing daylights, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. So, but it can play a role in, let's say you do have him 3 out of 5 nights, and you're like, man, I'm going to go in, but then that night you chose to hunt, it's hot. I wouldn't be hunting over the destination. I'd try and cut him off. I just don't think he's going to get there in time.
That's right. Yep. So, you know, temp's too high. And lastly, number 5. I could do a master course on this topic where guys just pay, they come to my farm, and I spend 2 days showing them this technique. Because, oh my, this is so bad. This is like a problem. It's like a virus that has taken over the hunting world. People just don't know how to set up trail cameras.
Nope.
So number 5 being your camera is in the wrong place.
I would think, honestly, let's say this. Okay, so I would put this easily on probably number 3 or 4 on the list. On the list of the top 5 here that we've got. I mean, this one is very big, third, I think, to the habitat.
Yeah.
The habitat's number 1, but then honestly, to document and to know how to frequently get deer on camera is I don't want to say it's a skill. I guess it's a skill because a lot of people don't have it, but they're just in some bad places to try and get the information that, as a hunter, you're seeking.
Yeah. And there's a lot of guys that I openly admit they don't know how to set up cameras. I've written management plans and drawn up maps where I laid out camera locations.
Yep.
Not because, you know, because they asked me. They were humble enough to say, I just don't feel like I get this that well. Can you please put on the maps camera locations? Like, sure, I had no idea people really wanted that, but I'm here to help you. You hired me to help you. So let's do it, by golly. Yep. And, you know, that goes to say we've traveled all over the country, and I've hunted a lot of farms over the years, and I've seen camera locations and setups. And there's more bad ones than there are good ones.
Yes.
How many times, Matt, on a consult, do you go by a camera and you say, what are they even looking at?
Right. Hooves? That one's facing the ground.
Are we looking for ticks on top of their heads?
Yeah. I think I'm supposed to say this.
Well, we sound pretty awful this week.
Say again.
I said we sound pretty awful this week. I'm coughing. You're snotting. And...
Yeah, I think that for many years, articles and just the general flow of the use of trail cameras was to only place trail cameras where you can get to them easily.
Yeah.
It was very low intrusion camera placements. And I think that that set a tone for a lot of poorly placed cameras. And I would say to a lot of people, let's say you have 30 cameras on your place. Give me 15.
Yeah.
And placed right. And sell the other ones, because half of them are just in the wrong places that you're not going to be able to get the type of information that you're looking for to then know what's happening on the property. And so you started out with, as people were learning and getting cameras out, that is very, you know, below intrusion. Don't even hardly step off the buggy to, you know, off a road system to grab a camera. I was like, what? No. Now, especially when we have technology like a cellular camera or the CuddyLink system that links cameras up, you better believe those puppies are going in areas that, my gosh, I don't personally want to step foot in, but I get the information I need to out of them.
Yeah.
Like that's if you have a tool and you're not utilizing the tool to its fullest capability, then you're just cutting yourself short. And I think that's the issue with a lot of camera placements. And so therefore the end result is what? Nocturnal pictures. And that deer really isn't moving or isn't nocturnal. He really is moving during daylight, but not where you have them set up.
That's right. And so it could be on the edge of a mediocre food plot. And you're like, how? He's nocturnal. Well, he's moving in the day like crazy up there in the other field.
Yeah. So real quick, because I think people, we don't talk a lot about that note there, Adam. What is your one of your favorite camera type setups that you're looking for? That you're like, okay, this is going to be a good one throughout the fall.
So my all time, and this has come over years. I mean. I don't want to toot my own horn. I'm not doing this. I just want people to understand how long I've ran trail cameras. I bought the very first one, so I'm 34 now, and I believe I was 11 when I bought it. So 23 years of using trail cameras. And I've used almost every main brand. Reconyx, Cuddybacks, Bushnells, Radix. Browning,
Moultrie.
Stealth Cam, Moultrie,
lots.
Yeah, I think that's pretty well the gist. Sorry if there's other ones out there that I didn't mention. I know there are some new ones. So I've used a ton of trail cameras over the years, and you know, worked with companies or properties that had dozens and dozens and dozens of trail cameras. So running them has been a big part of my job. And now it's a big part of my, like on my own farm, monitoring populations and herd dynamics and different things. So I absolutely, it's one of my favorite things to do on a farm. So if you're asking me my favorite absolute setup to getting deer and building a hunting strategy, it's not food plots. It's not roads. It really comes down to a simple location in conjunction with dense cover. And I believe, in my opinion, if I could draw up a perfect world.
And topography, I'm going to throw that one.
Yeah, could be topography. It could be topography, or it could be a little opening. But there's one thing that comes, two things that really come into play. And it is, and this is during the fall, because there's other times of the year I have different ways of liking it, but if it's during the fall, let's just say September to December, my favorite thing, two things come into play, or I guess my favorite location for using trail cameras, there's two things that come into play. It's proximity or relationship to dense bedding, and number two being scrape, mock scrape, some sort of communication. I look at it like this. If I'm close to, if I go onto a college campus, and hopefully my wife can't hear me through these walls. I mean, I'm going to say I'm now 19, rolling onto a college, trying to find a date. And I'm like, where's the most foot traffic? Where's the best place to meet girls? Where am I going to see them constantly.
The front door to the dormitory.
The front door to the dormitory, but better yet, where's a spot they would slow down? Step inside the dormitory, find the lounge, find the bulletin board, you know, dial it back, because now it's all digitized, so... But go back.
The cork board.
The cork board that's got all the like events and all the things coming up, convocations, all those. That's all listed.
You're really showing your age right now.
Yeah, I know. But that's where you go. So I'm trying to find the dormitory, and then I'm trying to find the bulletin board that talks about all the events coming up and who's all here. So and all the classifieds, and so.
And real quick, I want to say this. That doesn't happen on the main roads of your farm and on the edges of the food plot.
No.
You can capture deer on the edges of food plots. Absolutely. They work scrapes there totally. But guess what? A lot of it can be nocturnal.
Yeah.
But to kill them, we're not killing them at night. We're killing them legally. And that means they need to be placed off those edges. So it's not to say that deer won't be there. You can get them there, and you can get great camera photos, but we're talking highest probability and capturing the most useful information happens in these locations.
So I think of a couple places, couple camera locations really stick out. Big Piney really sticks out. That's where I shot my buck last year. That was probably our number – it was in our top three. I think it was our number one camera all fall last year. A little bitty opening, maybe an eighth of an acre, right next to – a bedding area that we had cut out that fall or that previous February. So really dense cover, little opening with some scrapes in it. So it was like, who's in the area right next to this bedding area? Go check the scrapes, because whoever's been here has been in these scrapes. They've went to the bulletin board, or they've went to the front desk and they've signed in. They've swiped their card and they've came in the dorm. That's where that tells me who's here and who's not.
When you have known bedding just outside on the fringe of that somewhere.
Yeah.
And again, you have to have known bedding.
On a scrape.
A permanent feature on a property. It can't just be like wide open timber.
Yep.
A known bedding area, good cover. There will be a big main scrape there coming out of the heaviest use trails. That's where we're talking.
Yeah. Yeah, and another one is a saddle. So going into that terrain feature, if you've got a saddle, let's just say one of my other favorite ones is South Saddle on Whistling Woodlands, where we've got, you know, not even that dense of cover, not even that dense of bedding, but they bed on it because it is in a really nice terrain feature, and there is some younger vegetation that grows in there. So they bed there, and then they cut through that saddle because every other part of the ridge is pretty high. So they take the path of least resistance, and they shoot through the saddle. And it's a great place. So we put up a big scrape. They roll through it. We don't have a camera there now because of the logger, so whatever. I'm not bitter about it at all. But that's another phenomenal one. So if you're taking it from me, where would I have my cameras if I had a choice? It would be in dense cover right next to dense cover on some sort of mock scrape or scrape to really check who's been in there.
So main takeaway of the podcast is if you don't have
improve your habitat.
Stop complaining about bucks being nocturnal. Create it. Move your cameras to the right places, and if it's still an issue, then let's dive deeper. We'll discuss that on a later podcast and help you on your property.
Yeah.
But until then, that's number one. You've got to have it. You got to create it, and you have the power to do so because it's just a matter of cutting trees.
You're a private landowner. Yes. Okay. And your bucks are nocturnal. Yes. Your fault.
Right. I mean, right. At the end of the day, that's what we're saying. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
This is important of realizing that it is that way and that you are the one who is in control of it. Take the next step and change it.
Yep.
We're happy to help you.
Yep.
So hopefully that helps everyone in the whole nocturnal realm and all the fury that's going to come out in the next let's say, month and a half of social media and this and that and questions that come up, make sure you identify these 5 points and see where you fall into it and make the necessary changes for the upcoming seasons. But hopefully that was helpful, guys.
Yeah, no doubt. Guys, we appreciate it, and we'll catch you next week.
See you.